when they're not broadcasting.
This is Steve Mazura.
Robin from the Aussie Kaleidoscope.
Living on the edge.
I'm Roger Cool.
The KJS Show.
Hi, this is Patrick Perdue from
the ACBRI DJs are hard at work creating personal web pages about their shows, the music they play, and even a bit about themselves.
Now we're accumulating these web pages into the ACB Radio Interactive Broadcasters Web Ring, where you can learn more about the personalities behind the microphone. Go to www.acbradio.org, then choose the interactive link. From there, you can choose the link that will take you to the ACB Radio Interactive Broadcasters Web Ring.
Hello, familiar music, heralds another blind line on ACB Radio Mainstream. My name's Jonathan Mosen, and it's my pleasure to be with you over the next couple of hours or so. We have an interesting program in store because on the show this week is ACB President Paul Edwards, and he's joining us from home in Florida. Paul, very good evening to you.
And a good evening to you too, Jonathan.
It's nice to have you on the show, and we've got so much to talk about. First of all, I wondered if we could start, and we have got a call on the board, so we'll come to that shortly, but in your president's message back in about, I think, December of last year, you did make some comments about the state of the economy in the U.S., the fact that, at least until recently, and indeed according to the latest stats, the economy is pretty buoyant, and that always does have an impact on thrift stores, and that is a major source of ACB's income. Can you give us an update as to how finances are with ACB at the moment?
Yeah, actually, the first 3 months of this year have been considerably better than we'd expected them to be. We've actually done very well with some of our state affiliates kicking in some much-needed funds, which have helped. Our thrift stores have actually done better than last year by a considerable margin over the first 3 months of this year. And we've also managed to be the beneficiaries of a couple of bequests. And though much of the bequest money has gone into our reserves because there's a board rule that requires us to put everything above $75,000 into board reserves, and we've done that, it certainly made our financial situation a lot brighter than it was in December.
But are you still anticipating a deficit?
No. We'll probably be holding a budget committee meeting this week to look at lessening some of the fairly restrictive approaches that we decided to take in our last budget. My anticipation is that meeting will take place by conference call sometime this week.
It must be a bit frightening, though, the fact that it could just bottom out so badly. I mean, it's obviously heartening that it can peak again like it has, but you must be always hoping that there must be some greater degree of stability in ACB's finances than there currently appears to be.
Right. I think that one of the things that the board of ACB has been looking to do for the past several years has been to find ways of making ACB less dependent on our thrift stores and finding other sources of revenue. And we've done that to a degree. There was a time when 80 to 90% of ACB's revenues came from thrift stores, and now they're down to about 65 to 67%. So we're making some progress in that regard. We continue to work on other issues. You know, we hope that some of our members will decide that that, for instance, the email outfit that ACB is promoting at the moment will be something that will be a benefit to them, because every person who goes on to that particular email service provider will end up earning ACB $4 a month, which is $48 a year, which is a considerable sum of money. And if large numbers went on to that, of course, it would be very good. Unfortunately, right now they don't have high speed. They just have 56K access. But for many of our members, that's all they're getting anyway.
Yeah, actually, we should do something on main menu about that. You'll forgive me for asking the sort of pointed questions, but I guess that's what ACB pays me to do. Why is there so much difference in terms of the the finances that NFB seem to have access to. I mean, it appears, on the surface at least, to be a very, very wealthy organization. Why is there such a contrast between the two?
Well, the NFB has chosen to use some methods for fundraising that ACB doesn't use at the moment. They do get an awful lot more money from their members than we do on monthly pledges and a variety of things like that. They've also, I think, been prepared to put their stamp of approval on certain products in exchange for financial contributions, which ACB has so far not been prepared to do. And they've also raised a lot of funds by getting into the federal grants business, which, to my mind, lessens their capacity to be an effective consumer voice, because if you're a hybrid of a consumer organization and a service provider, one wonders in which camp you actually are. But I think those are some of the reasons. They also have a very historically long mail order fundraiser that actually isn't through the NFB, but is through a number of subsidiary organizations that uses approaches to funding appeals that ACB would probably shun because of the degree to which they portray blind people in ways that we're not comfortable portraying ourselves.
So you're saying there's some sort of conflict there between the philosophy the NFB espouses and the portrayal of blind people in fundraising materials?
I think that's true in some of the fundraising entities that they use. Some of the campaign letters for the National Brotherhood of the Blind, for example, have been in the past. I haven't seen them for many years now, but have certainly in the past been things that I don't think ACB's board would approve.
Is ACB too wimpy when it comes to fundraising, though? Is that why it's somewhat vulnerable to these troughs like the one that you've just had?
Probably. I think fundraising is certainly not one of my strengths. As president, we do have a development committee which is working on a number of issues, but I think it's fair to say that fundraising is getting harder and harder in the not-for-profit sector, and particularly for a consumer organization that isn't prepared to sell itself to anyone. It is tough to raise funds in an America that really wants you to try to portray the fundraising effort that you're looking for in ways that make it easier to raise funds. I mean, it's tough to raise funds when you're essentially saying what you want is for consumers to be regarded as equal citizens. And there's something of a contradiction between that and the kind of approach that essentially says give the poor blind people money because they're in pitiable condition.
Yeah.
You know, it's a tough tightrope to walk. If you're really interested in civil rights, then clearly one of the things that you're going to sacrifice is the ability to raise funds appropriately and effectively.
And you're competing for people's discretionary charitable dollar, I suppose, against very worthy causes such as undernourished children in many developing countries, etc.
Right, as well as people who aren't scrupulous about the approach they use. I mean, there's a famous example in the United States, the Jerry Lewis Labor Day telethon that portrays disabled people in ways that even at this late stage in my presidency, I'd get impeached if I tried to portray blind people in that way.
It's never too late, Paul.
I see.
What was I going to ask after? Oh, yes. So would you support some sort of state, federal funding of advocacy organizations like ACB?
You know, it's a really interesting question. You look at a lot of other countries like Australia and like New Zealand where there is government and state contributions to consumer organizations, and I don't think it seriously impeded their capacity to function. So, I mean, if we could arrange some kind of a system where partnerships could develop I would certainly have no major objection to it, so long as it didn't impede ACB's ability to operate independently and competently as the voice of consumers. I think that's the toughest issue. In New Zealand, for example, I think it's sometimes difficult to be absolutely comfortable with the notion that the consumer voice is pure if a lot of funding were to come from the agency in New Zealand. And I think Australia's lucky because they're the only consumer organization and because in a lot of respects they're the only national voice. I think in Canada the situation has been that consumer movement has been to a large degree held back because of the degree to which consumer organizations were until recently tied to the CNIB. So, it depends an awful lot on each country. I think it's absolutely crucial, though, that ACB maintain its ability to speak as a consumer organization and not be impeded by any notion of being a part of the service provider network. And I think that's where it's tough, because in most state and federal funding analyses, where the money would come from would probably be from services to the blind or perhaps from the Department of Education at the federal level. The ACB has in the past taken a couple of federal grants that have been advocacy grants, and I think we'd certainly look at some more of those because I don't think they impede us. But can you speak clearly and unequivocally on the issue of employment if, in fact, you have grants with the Department of Labor?
Well, there's an interesting paradigm shift that's gone on here, because during the height of the Jernigan presidency of the NFB, the NFB certainly put out the perception that it was ACB that was the kind of agency lackey that would essentially do whatever the agency said and not protest, not make the hard decisions. So it's funny how there's a whole paradigm shift that's gone on in the last few years, where, to the extent that NFB has indulged in some activities that some people would say now constituted as an agency for the blind, as a service provider.
Yeah, I think that the paradigm that NFB marketed then was not very accurate. ACB has always been prepared to work with anybody, including the Federation, if it was likely to benefit people who are blind. I think the Federation's portrayal of ACB as the lackey of service providers was in fact an inaccurate portrayal anyway. I think that service providers have perhaps moved in the direction of being more consumer-oriented, at least on the face of it, which has made it easier for the Federation to work with them. But I think at the same time, in our view, they may have moved towards a place where they're not actually as innovative or as careful about being even-handed in their consumer involvement as they should be.
If you would like to speak with Paul Edwards, you can call in at any time, courtesy of spiderphone.com, and our number is area code 212-812-2800. That's area code 212-812-2800, and the access code is 0480-5512. That's 0480-5512 if you wish to speak with Paul Edwards. And Nick, thank you for waiting.
Hi, Paul.
Hi.
What is going on here with ACB and NFB? What is all the publicity about with ACB and NFB? What is there, some sort of quarrel?
There's a young man wanting you to bang your heads together, Paul.
Okay. I think that people would probably say there's a quarrel going on. I think there's just some differences philosophically. I wouldn't say that we're interested in fighting with the Federation. We disagree with some decisions that they're taking at the moment. There are probably five areas where we're fundamentally opposed to them that are active at the moment. One of them is over the issue of descriptive video, also over the issue of accessible pedestrian signals, also over the issue of the use of detectable warnings at curbs. Fourth, we're concerned about the position that they've taken with regard to how vocational rehabilitation should regard sheltered work. And fifth, they're unhappy with us, I think, over what they perceive to be our attack on their fundraising efforts over their building in Baltimore. So those are the five areas where we're disagreeing right now.
I see. It's just that the thing is, like, I mean, like, the first few, like, the first three were, like, I mean, like, should be non-negotiable. Those things, I have a big opinion on those. Those first three, those accessibilities should be non-negotiable.
Yeah, I agree with that.
In favor
of ACB, I hope.
Well, you're right. If you're in favor of the if you're in favor of all that,
absolutely, we're in favor of all three.
All right then. I mean, you really need that.
I think so too. I absolutely agree with that.
I mean, like you think about if in last year's convention, I heard the main menu archive is like they were showing how the there was this left to right pedestrian cross signal that emitted a tone to the left and the right.
Yep.
And they really should start to have national, the Federation and the Council should start to think about putting those in.
I couldn't agree more. I'd like to see the Federation and the Council working with every community in the United States to make that happen.
Right.
There you go.
By the way, what were you about to say? I didn't want to interrupt.
Oh no, go ahead. Did you have another point you wanted to make, Nick?
Yes, but I just would like to know what happened last week. Like, I tried to dial 0480-5512 and it said, sorry, this conference is over.
That's because Blindline was earlier last week. If you subscribe to one of our lists, the announcements list or the friends list, you get information like that. So you may like to join one of those lists.
I tried, but Major Domo wasn't really working too well.
It may be because you're sending the messages in HTML format. If you can send in plain text, Major Domo likes it a whole lot better. Yeah. Hey, I really appreciate your call, Nick. I think that your perspective as a younger person and hopefully a potential member of one or other consumer organizations...
ACB, Jonathan.
Yeah, is really valuable.
ACB, almost definitely.
Excellent.
Absolutely.
Good on you.
That's what I like to hear.
Nice to hear from you, Nick. I appreciate it.
Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye. Did you think that it puts people off, though, Paul? I mean, if you look at a youngster like Nick, who's obviously keen, he's an ACB radio listener, he follows what's going on, and he sees... the disagreement and the bickering, you can't help wonder not only what other blind people who aren't involved in consumerism are thinking, but also what decision makers are thinking about all of this.
Well, I guess that if I had had one hope at the beginning of my 6 years as president, it would have been that we'd be able to build a relationship where ACB and NFB would be on a kind of a permanent... a permanent road towards cooperation, and I think I'm probably more disappointed than most that that's not where we are. My position has always been that wherever it's possible, the blindness community needs to appear to be united, and that every time the ACB and the NFB find themselves at different places, it enables people who aren't interested in doing much for blind people anyway to use our differences as an excuse not to take action. So it's very bothersome to me that we find ourselves at odds on so many issues. I think it's important for people to realize, though, that there are an awful lot of issues where we're not at odds and where we are working very closely together in Washington and throughout the country. And that includes generally our views of how rehab ought to operate. That certainly includes the issue of copyright. It certainly includes our approach to education, the importance of Braille, and some of the changes that have occurred in American education law. And it obviously applies to ATM machines and to a range of other accessibility options that we're in agreement should exist. I think we're probably pretty much on the same page in terms of access to information, the attitudes towards Microsoft. And while we don't agree that it was necessary to sue AOL, I think that we're in general concurrence that that AOL needed to become more accessible.
Let's talk about audio description, because we had a pretty lively discussion about that on the program last week, and it was good to know that there were people from the NFB perspective who felt comfortable about ringing us and expressing an opinion, and I think that's symptomatic of the way that ACB Radio tries to run itself. But let's talk about audio description from the council's perspective. And I guess I have to say, it leaves one with a feeling of incredulity, does it not, that a blindness organization would use presumably members' money to try and decimate a victory so hard won by so many blind people?
Well, and an organization that in fact right from the beginning was actively involved with audio description. You know, in looking back at the history of audio description, one of the things that sort of stands out is that there were two funders of the first live broadcast of audio description, which was the 1993 inauguration. One of those funders was the Department of Education, no surprise there, but the other was the National Federation of the Blind. And it seems amazing to me that an organization that would get so fundamentally behind an entity would suddenly decide that it's irrelevant and unimportant. And I guess that my incredulity goes one step further, in that I truly have a serious problem with the NFB taking a position that chooses to limit the capacity of a government agency to make rules in favor of people who are blind, because that seems to me to put at risk so many other things down the road, and it seems to me as well to put the NFB so far out in left field from the rest of the blindness community. I think the other thing that we need to recognize is it isn't just the ACB and the NFB that have worked together to create audio description. The American Foundation for the Blind, AER, which is the Association for the Education and Rehabilitation of the Blind and Visually Impaired, the Blinded Veterans Association, and a range of other blindness organizations have all worked together. This is a blindness community thing where there was no disagreement up until, say, a year and a half, 2 years ago, when the Federation suddenly withdrew its support.
Do you know why that happened? Why the support was withdrawn?
I don't claim to have any understanding of the decision making within the National Federation of the Blind. Clearly, if you believe their resolution, it was that they don't have any major objection to audio description, but believe that there are more important issues out there that people ought to be concerned about. And I think it sort of goes along with their philosophy that appears to say that blind people shouldn't ask society to do very much for them, because if they ask society to do much for them, society won't want to accept blind people fully.
And you don't accept that? You don't think that there is a danger in unnecessary accommodations sending the wrong message?
Well, I think it depends whether you describe accommodations as unnecessary. It seems to me that that if blind people were asking for free telephone service because of the fact that they depend so much on the telephone, that would be an unnecessary accommodation. But to ask to have the same access to television that everyone else has, so that they can fully enjoy it, to ask to have the same access to movies so that they can fully participate in movies, is simply asking to have the same access that the rest of society takes for granted and that have already been granted, for example, to people who are deaf through the use of captioning. I don't think those are unnecessary accommodations. I think that's simply equal access to services for citizens.
Mighty hard for me to play devil's advocate on that one. Area code 214. Hello, you're speaking with Paul Edwards.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
This is Wayne from Dallas, Texas.
Hi, Wayne.
Hey. I have a couple questions and a comment for you. The first question is, I guess I should say that I'm coming at this from an NFE perspective, but
mm-hmm.
these aren't to be. I don't want to sound critical or anything like that.
You're welcome to be as critical as you want, Wayne. We're glad to at least explore ideas with anyone who's interested, and particularly with folks in the Federation, because it's certainly always been my view that while the National Federation may have policies with which I disagree, there aren't very many members of the Federation who I haven't liked.
Okay, well, that's great to know. First question is, I heard it stated a couple of years ago that if you could boil down the positions of the NFB and ACB down to one statement, it would be something like, the NFB believes that blind people should adapt to the world, and the ACB believes that the world should adapt to the blind. And I wanted to get your opinion or your take on that statement there.
I think the actual position is somewhere in the middle. I think it's unrealistic for the Federation to expect all people who are blind to adapt to the world, because at the moment there simply isn't enough money being allocated to train older people who are at least half of the blind population. More than that, I think there are an awful lot of blind people let me put it another way. I think that in every community and in every organization, you're going to find blind people who are at different levels of competence. And I don't think there's any way you're ever going to change that. I think that both organizations ought to be in favor of, and I know ACB is, and I think NFB is, ought to be in favor of the best training possible for people who are blind. And I think we're far from having that in this country right now, but I truly do believe that many blind people are never going to achieve the competence that would be necessary to survive in the world that the Federation seems to want us to build. So from our perspective, we need to try to have the world adapt so as to encourage the people who are blind who aren't as well trained as the super blinks that I think the Federation aims at producing, so that those folks can get access to the world as well. Sure, there are superb travelers who probably do fine without accessible pedestrian signals, without detectable warnings, but I think that blind people as a group benefit more from society recognizing that there is an obligation of society to try to create a capacity for blind people to have greater access to the built environment by making the built environment more friendly. That's kind of a long answer to your first question, but I hope it helps.
Yeah, kind of cleared up things a little bit there.
Okay.
The other one, and this is not so much a philosophical thing as
mm-hmm.
I guess a way of doing things that I've wondered about and
mm-hmm.
haven't gotten a chance to ask one about yet. Why is it that the ACB has, or seems to have, any term limits for their elected officers, and not only that I've seen in the national organization, but also in their divisions, and the NFB doesn't.
Well, I can't comment on why the NFB doesn't, except to relay to you what I've been told. It's their belief that, that if you've got a really good leader who's competent and capable and charismatic, that person ought to have the opportunity to serve as long as he or she wishes. Because the ACB was formed out of a disagreement over the lack of democracy that we perceived existed in the Federation, we've built a constitution that includes term limits. I think personally that term limits make sense. I think they make sense because I think that it's important to create a broad cadre of leaders in the blindness field. The fact that I will cease to be ACB's president in July doesn't mean that I'm going to withdraw my involvement in ACB. I'll continue to serve as immediate past president and will continue to work actively on issues that I think are important to ACB. But another leader will have an opportunity to emerge and will have an opportunity to express perhaps a slightly different viewpoint than mine, and perhaps far more eloquently than I can, the position that ACB tries to take in the world. I think from our perspective, if you focus attention on a single charismatic leader, when that leader disappears, you place your organization at a good deal more risk because there isn't the available group of subsidiary leaders who are out there who can then step in and take that person's place. That may be a misapprehension. Dr. Maurer for the Federation has been president for a long time. One doesn't know who is in line to replace him should he step down. So we'll just have to wait and see. But I think our view is that our approach gives more diversity to leadership and also encourages the expectation of others within the organization that they too can move into leadership positions as a matter of course, because the old guard's going to go away.
I appreciate your questions, Wayne, and thank you for phoning in to submit them.
Can I do one quick comment?
Sure. A very quick comment, yep.
Okay. Thank you for having ACB Radio, because it's
Go out as long as you like.
Okay. Thanks for having ACB Radio, because it's given, NFE people that may not know a whole bunch about the history to learn about that and learn about other facets of blind people that they might have heard from or heard of but not know anything about, and that kind of thing.
Wayne, I don't know if Jonathan mentioned it, but we had invited Dr. Maurer to participate on ACB Radio with a discussion on this whole audio description issue and perhaps on other differences, and he declined that invitation.
Yeah, he did indeed.
Yeah, that's been talked about quite a bit on the NFP list that I'm on.
Well, we continue to encourage Dr. Maurer to enter into a frank and open discussion with ACB. I'd certainly love to have the opportunity to share a platform with him and talk about some of the differences that exist between our organizations. I think the blind people of the United States and the world would benefit from that.
Excellent.
All right.
Thanks,
well,
Wayne.
I'll let you go.
Okay. Thanks for phoning in.
Sure.
Bye-bye now. This is Blind Line on ACB Radio Mainstream, and yes, if I sound like I'm pushing things along, we're getting lots of people backing up on the board now, and I'm conscious of the fact that many are calling long distance. Morristown, New Jersey, hello.
Good afternoon. afternoon, Mr. Mosen and Paul and Miss Paul Edwards. This is Marvin Rush.
Hi, Marvin.
Hi there, Marvin.
I've had a change of, shall I call it a midlife employment change since I talked to you?
Better than a midlife crisis, anyway.
Yeah, well, there you go.
If you were unemployed, we could call it a sort of a menopause.
There you go. I was employed. Last time I talked to both of you, I was in Louisiana, vision teacher in Louisiana. That's one of the questions I want to ask you.
Uh-huh.
And now I am a field rep for Seeing Eye.
Well, that's excellent.
And it's been a big change, and maybe I'll call Jonathan during the second hour, and we can talk about that, because going from the southern United States to the East Coast, it has been a big change, but it's been a fun change. My question for you is, this next weekend is the Louisiana Council of the Blind's convention, state convention. And I got word the other day that Louisiana is in the process of trying something I believe that Florida has tried or maybe is doing now, and that is contract out the rehabilitation services. Do you have any comments on that?
Well, from the perspective of someone who lives in Florida, I'm happy to tell you that the contracted services have so far not gone into effect, largely because the Rehabilitative Services Administration in Washington, D.C., has essentially indicated that the approach that's being taken in Florida doesn't meet the federal guidelines for allowing vocational rehabilitation services to be delivered appropriately in Florida. As a result, everything is kind of in abeyance in Florida. I believe that privatization, which essentially is what this is, of vocational rehabilitation services is a horrible idea. I don't think it has very much merit. I think it's something that organizations of blind people ought to fight wherever it rears its ugly head. Vocational rehabilitation services in Florida did not include services to people who are blind because we have a separate agency. You know, they would in Louisiana.
Yes.
Obviously, we're very concerned about this direction. We will certainly work with our affiliate in Louisiana, as well as with any other organizations who are like-minded, to try to ensure that privatization doesn't happen. I think in Florida, one of the significant things about privatization is there wasn't the outcry of consumers against privatization that I would have expected to see or hear. And I think that perhaps says something about the way that consumers perceive vocational rehabilitation as we get into the 21st century. I think that state agencies, whether they're separate or combined, need to be concerned about the degree to which they are losing consumer support, whether it's consumer support from blindness organizations or consumer support from other consumer organizations, because it's my view that the next round of reauthorization of the Rehabilitation Act is going to have some very serious questions about whether vocational rehabilitation is the appropriate way to deliver services to the disabled people of the United States.
Well, my main concern would be, just thinking about it, it would turn vocational rehabilitation into a money-making affair, because first thing you know that there's no one going to bid on these contracts unless they figure they can make money.
Well, the way it worked in Florida was existing private agencies would have agreed to provide the services that vocational rehabilitation counselors had provided, so that individuals who were formerly already employed by private agencies in the state would have assumed some of the responsibilities of vocational rehabilitation counselors. I think that it certainly was alleged to be a cost-cutting exercise. I think the net impact of privatization would have been to lessen client choice, as well as to limit the appropriate relationship that is supposed to exist between a certified rehabilitation counselor and his or her client under the Rehab Act. And frankly, that's been the primary reason that privatization has been attacked in Florida by the feds, who are, I think, quite rightly convinced that they don't have guarantees that within the private agencies there will be the same ability to monitor that client choice and all of the other elements of the Rehabilitation Act are being appropriately carried through.
Right, because I know that in Texas, the Commission for the Blind, they encourage, in fact, within the next few years, they will require all their counselors to have master's degrees in rehab, and, you know, therefore, that commission is striving to better their services. And I would fear that if they go the other way in Louisiana, that would not be true.
Couldn't agree more. Thanks a lot for your call.
All right, you have a great evening, and Jonathan, probably talk to you in the second hour.
Marvelous. Well, we'll see how long Paul hangs in for, because the board's pretty full.
Okay, bye-bye.
Okay, bye now. And I'm not even going to try and pronounce the name of this town, so I'll just say hello to area code 631.
Hello, Jonathan. How are you doing this evening?
What is that? It says W Kinnack or something like that, New York.
Oh, really? It should say Comac.
Oh, it probably is. I'm just doing too much to think about it. How
yeah,
are you, Richard?
It's Comac. If that's what it's saying, because that's my area code, Comac.
And is the W? What does the W stand for? West.
I'm not quite sure. Yeah. I didn't know that there was a W in there.
All right, then. Yeah, well, it's probably...
That's odd, because there's no W in Comac.
It stands for Willing Caller.
It's in honor of your new president.
Yes, right. Yeah. Hello, sir. Glad to be talking with you. I'm Richard Pasta. I know Jonathan knows me quite well. I guess I have a comment, and I was wondering if you've heard on the Visual Computers Group, they had put out a WAV file on the current type of ATM machine that they had, a sample of a talking ATM that's going to be coming out.
Haven't actually heard the WAV file, no.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Well, I had taken a listen to it, and the way it presents to me is that it sounds more like the way it's designed to kind of be more less than a screen reader and more or something that is going to be actually reading the screen and more like someone standing next to you and telling you what the buttons are. And to me, I don't think that's really satisfactory. And the other thing that when you listen to the file, one thing it says that... it doesn't announce the decimal point, and that you're assumed to be putting it correctly. And at least with our screen readers, or even accessing my bank online with my computer, I mean, I know exactly where the decimal points and everything are. And it's kind of like I find that a little disconcerting, because I'd like to know where the decimal point is myself.
Some of the talking ATM machines that I've used have been better than others. I think most of them that are being deployed are actually pretty good, and they do announce decimal points. You know, there are some question marks as to how much you should let an ATM machine say. For instance, would you like it to give to say your PIN number out loud as you're putting it in?
Oh, obviously not.
Would you like it to announce your balance?
My balance is zero. Probably not.
one of the
things that I had, in other words, in the WAV file, it was not saying, like, in other words, there were maybe 10 buttons, and it was only mentioning what the function was for a couple of those buttons, not
right.
all the buttons that were
I
there.
I think that was really intended to be a sample of the speech. other than necessarily going through all of the functionality of the machines, because the machines actually do carry you through the transactions pretty well.
Yeah.
The assumption is that people will use earphones with these systems, and so that's why they've actually opted to go with the balance but not to go with the pin thing.
That makes sense, though, doesn't it? Because when you enter your pin as a sighted person on an ATM machine, wouldn't it just come up as a series of asterisks?
I think so.
Yeah, and so really the standard should be that a blind person through headphones gets exactly the same access to information as a sighted person does.
Mm-hmm. Yep, I agree.
Yeah.
I think they're getting a lot better in it, but I think the important thing to recognize is that in California, in Florida, in Ohio, in Indiana, in Pennsylvania, and I think in New England, we're now beginning to see talking ATMs deployed in large numbers, which means that really for the first time, blind people are going to have more independent access to taking money out for themselves. I think the other thing to recognize is that if it had not been for these ATM suits, I don't think the online banking that you're doing with your computer would be nearly as so accessible as it is now.
I would definitely agree. I guess my only, since you mentioned that, as far as that goes, do you think that it was a mistake for ACB not to be a part of the, with NFB as far as when they were originally suing AOL?
No, I don't. I continue to think that ACB was correct in its belief that that AOL was already working closely with a number of entities to try to make their system better. I think one of the significant things that we ought to take a look at is what were the net results of the NFB suit. They withdrew the suit, and the version that was supposed to be fully accessible and fully usable certainly is not.
Yeah.
And at the same time as they withdrew the suit, AOL announced a donation to NFB, and I think that
definitely sounds like collusion there at least.
One at least has to ask the question: Did the NFB withdraw from the AOL suit and take less than it might have gotten had it stayed in longer? You know, but no, I don't think I still don't believe that the correct approach to that problem was a lawsuit. Putting more pressure on them, trying to put more pressure on those entities with whom they were working, those are all viable things, and those are all things that ACB was doing.
Okay, and then my last comment as far as those original 5 points that you mentioned, I agree with all of them except for, of course, the first one as far as visually description, and I think... don't you think it would have been better for us to do this maybe along the same way that I can't think of the word right now, the deaf have...
Captioning?
Closed captioning as far as getting companies to... Because, you know, whenever you see a program that does have closed captioning, it says that it's sponsored. Do you think that would have been a better way of going about it than the way it... Now, I mean, obviously, this is the result, but don't you think it could have been handled better rather than having to actually have the FCC mandate it?
Well, the FCC, closed captioning only really became widespread when the FCC mandated it as well. It's mandated just in the same way, in fact, to a much greater degree than audio description is. Remember that... All that the FCC has said in their ruling is that in the top 20 markets, starting a year from now, there should be 4 hours of audio described programming on the major networks and major cable channels, only in those top 20 markets. So it's a very gradual approach. Closed captioning exists all over the country. It exists on about 70 to 80% of all the programming on television. Certainly, everything in prime time. What audio description is doing in its initial mock-up is very minimal.
There you go. Thank you very much for that, Richard.
All right, Jonathan.
Have a good one.
Take
care. Okay, bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
This is Blind Line on ACB Radio Mainstream, and hello to this unknown caller. Thank you for waiting.
Oh, I'm sorry, I'm an unknown caller. Good evening, Jonathan and Mr. Edwards, indeed. Hello,
Paul,
this is Dave Williams from the UK.
Hi.
Hello, hello. Good to speak with you. I'm glad, actually, you mentioned the quotes, 5 points on which you feel that the ACB and the NFB perhaps have a little bit of disagreement on, or more than a little bit. But that, for me, as somebody in the UK, I've been mystified for a long time as to what this is all about between the NFB and the ACB, and obviously ACB Radio was an ACB initiative, you know, when I realised that there was some sort of difference in position, I thought, well, who am I getting involved with? You know, I need to understand. I mean, ACB, this is something, the point of my call actually was to ask you about ACB Radio, and I'm really wanting you to sort of clarify for those that aren't aware, really, ACB Radio's sort of independence, really, and to just sort of clarify that in no way ACB Radio is the mouthpiece of the ACB. For example, last week, Jonathan was quite sort of happy to have people on, you know, from the NFB, and it's great for ACB Radio that, you know, we want to represent, you know, the sort of the spectrum of viewpoints.
One of the areas of disagreement that I talked about at the beginning of the program was over what they take to be our opposition to their fundraising efforts.
Right.
On our ACB list, and I suspect perhaps even occasionally through callers to ACB Radio talk shows, there have been some pretty disparaging and inappropriate comments made about the Federation's effort to raise money for a building. What I said to Dr. Maurer in public at a meeting of the Region of the World Blind Union was that ACB has never sought and will never seek to control what is said on its list, as NFB does, nor will we ever seek to muzzle ACB Radio. We believe that ACB Radio ought to be the mouthpiece of ACB, because we believe that ACB speaks for the notion that anybody has a right to express their opinions on any subject, as long as they do so in a decent and appropriate way. A core value of ACB, I think, is our belief that democracy must be honored above everything else, and the freedom of every individual to be heard and to speak out in whatever way they wish within our organization without reprisals is a core value that it probably makes governance much more difficult than it is in the NFB.
That's reassuring to hear you say that. That really is. Thank you. The other point also relates to ACB Radio, and I'm sure a lot of listeners will be interested in this. In July, when the ACB undergoes the change of leadership and you step down, ACB Radio, how much will that be influenced by that change?
I don't think any at all. ACB Radio is firmly ensconced in our budget. It's certainly been an initiative that I've worked hard to see happen, but I've also tried to persuade the members of ACB, and I think fairly successfully, that ACB Radio may be the most important thing ACB can do to forward the interests of people who are blind throughout the world. And I hope that's the way that ACB will continue to see ACB Radio. In my view, ACB Radio represents an opportunity for blind people all over the world to have access to an authentic voice of people who are blind and to be encouraged to participate as blind people themselves in getting questions about blindness answered. And as long as I'm around in ACB, I'll certainly fight very hard to make sure that rather than contracting, ACB Radio expands.
It's certainly a really exciting project, and I mean, we were only talking the other day, Jonathan and I, on one of the lists that, you know, with the development of the wireless internet in the coming years, you know, it would be fantastic if in years to come people could listen to programs like Blind Line, you know, on the bus or, you know, lying in bed just on, you know, some sort of receiver next to their bed or anything like that, you know, rather than having to be sort of tied to the desktop. And it's, you know, internet broadcasting is certainly cutting-edge media.
What we're trying to do in ACB is to encourage radio reading services in the U.S. and Canada and Australia and New Zealand, and hopefully, with your help in the U.K., to make some of the programming from ACB Radio available. And, and I reiterate to anyone who wants to hear it that ACB is not interested in any remuneration for the use of ACB Radio programs. What we are interested in is simply an acknowledgement that the program came from ACB Radio. But it truly bothers me, the small proportion of people who are blind who have the opportunity to benefit from what I think is the excellently high quality of programming that ACB Radio produces.
Well, we're certainly doing our best to try and get the word out. And I was at a communications day a couple of weeks ago at a local charity here, and, you know, really sort of trying to spread the word about ACB Radio and saying, look, you know, this is an international thing. This isn't just Americans. You know, this isn't, you know, by sort of blind Americans for blind Americans. This is, you know, this is an international thing. You've got a guy in New Zealand running the whole shaboodle. You know, here I am and sort of in the UK coordinating the ACB Radio interactive side of things. And I think one of the seriously underrated resources of ACB Radio, and this, I just can't imagine the amount of disk space that it must take up, is the on-demand sort of archive. There are so many things in there, you know, so many hours of tutorials that you know, normally you would have to go out and pay a load of money for, that you can just have a look through and see, you know, is there a program perhaps that I've got that somebody's done a little review on, or somebody's you know, explain how you would go about using this and all this sort of thing. And that on-demand archive, you know, if you take 5 minutes to look through it, that is a fabulous resource that has grown over the last 18 months or so. And, you know, and it can only get better as more content is added.
Couldn't agree more. But I think ACB Radio is here to stay. I hope it'll be extended. I hope we'll be able to do even more with it. One of these years, we're going to have to figure out some method whereby people who contribute to ACB Radio can actually get paid a little money, because we're going to run out of the patience of volunteers. I don't know how we're going to do that yet, but we're going to work on it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm fortunate enough at the moment that I do have quite a lot of free time. I work a couple of days for a local charity, but that's the only, you know, I'm in the face with the situation that most blind people, as you well know, are faced with of that of unemployment. And I do regularly, you know, put in job applications and go to interviews and this sort of thing, you know, and consider myself to be a sort of moderately intelligent person, but you know, and I think I have employable skills, but you know, employment just isn't forthcoming at the moment. So I've got these couple of days with this charity that I do on a weekly basis, and the rest of my time, you know, is available to sort of work on these voluntary sort of online projects. I'm involved with a couple of other things, and, you know, I'm only too glad to be involved with ACB Radio. Obviously, I appreciate the appointment and from the new, you know, at the moment, as far as things stand for me, but in terms of, you know, attracting new people and perhaps, you know, providing some sort of, you know, basic employment and that sort of thing, you know, it could potentially generate marvelous opportunities for people, you know, just to sort of get them off benefit and get them, you know, just get them up and running, get them started at least, you know, get them something on their resume and that sort of thing.
In fact, I think we're going to be looking at perhaps trying to see if we can actually get a federal grant that would allow us to do some of that.
Mm-hmm. Well, the best of luck, certainly. And we appreciate you coming back on and talking to us. You know, so often, you know, people think that the leadership and everything are sort of far removed from your average, you know, Joe Public who perhaps tunes in, you know, once in a while or whatever. And certainly we appreciate you coming back on, and I hope that your successor will come on and be just as vocal as yourself.
Oh, I hope so too.
He's far removed from...
Okay, thanks very much, Jonathan.
Okay,
thanks,
Mr. Edwards,
and we hope to speak to you again very soon.
Okay, bye-bye. Bye-bye. I was going to say, Paul, you're far removed from me. You're in Florida, and I'm in Whanganui.
That's right, and it's raining here, too.
Oh, well, there you go, you see. I have to say, Dave's something pretty special, actually. He's got ACB Radio Interactive up to well over 100 hours a week of live blind programming, music-type radio on that stream.
And the cool thing is that so many of those folks are younger, which is exciting to me because it suggests that ACB Radio is going to have not only the listenership but the producers into the future.
I'm sure you're right, and the explosion of devices that make internet broadcasting independent of the PC is exciting. But in terms of the whole question of profile raising of ACB Radio, just while we're on that subject, we're certainly hoping to make a bit of a splash at this year's convention.
Oh, I hope so. We're planning to mainstream more and more of the convention, and I don't know how much you've talked on ACB Radio because I haven't had a chance to listen very much lately about our pre-election coverage. But
I wasn't sure whether the BOP had signed that off, so we haven't said anything about it at this point, and if you're in a position to do that, that'd be great.
I don't know if they've signed off or not either, but I'm going to talk about it anyway.
Okay, that's your prerogative as president.
This is presidential prerogative. You know, lame ducks can do anything. We are planning for the first time this year to set up a web page where candidates will have the opportunity to put their kind of curriculum vitae and answers to five questions up. We'll be asking everybody to answer the same five questions. But in addition, we've created a role for ACB Radio so that in the latter part of June, Jonathan will have the opportunity to interview all of the announced candidates who are up on the webpage, and then during the convention, late arriving candidates will be interviewed by Jonathan in breaks during the convention session and perhaps on special programs, depending on how that works. In addition, we will, of course, be broadcasting and streaming the candidates' forum for the first time this year, which is a kind of a neat exercise that we do every year where candidates appear in a kind of a debate setting. It's not quite a debate setting, but similar to that, for about an hour and a half on the Thursday evening of our convention. So we're looking forward to getting the world involved in ACB democracy so that they can better understand how it is that we do things, as well as enabling people to have a much better picture of the candidates who are running and how they think and feel before they actually have to either cast their votes or call in to the person in charge of their affiliate about how they're going to cast their votes.
You know, we're looking forward to that, and it's going to be exciting. I do see we have had a call or two who have already appeared on the program, and just in the interests of fairness, I'm not going to take those calls because we do have calls stacking up, and I want everyone to have a chance to fire questions at Paul. And Steve Matsura is going to do that now. Good evening to you.
Good evening, Jonathan, and good evening, Mr. President.
Hey, Steve.
How are you doing?
Doing well.
Very well. I was reading the latest forum, and granted there just aren't enough hours in the day to keep up with everything, and I ran across an article that I thought you might be interested in talking to us a little bit about. It was an article that went into great depth and detail over something that was only referred to kind of offhandedly as the Garrett decision. And I was wondering if this is something that you could talk about and expand upon and maybe give a little history of for those of us who, frankly, don't know what it is and why it's important for blind people.
The Garrett decision was a decision that was made by the Supreme Court. And at one level, it was a very narrow decision in that the Garrett decision, in its simplest terms, simply said that it was no longer legal for a state employee to sue for damages a state employer if that individual was suing on the basis of the Americans with Disabilities Act. So in terms of its actual impact on the long-range effectiveness of the Americans with Disabilities Act, it was a pretty narrow decision. What's more worrying about the decision is some of the language that was used, because there was a suggestion in the majority opinion of the Supreme Court, and it was another of these 5-4 decisions, that in fact some of the accommodations that states are providing to employees with disabilities may not be appropriate, and that it in fact may be appropriate for a state to make a rational decision not to provide accommodations at all. That's very worrying. It's also very worrying to those of us who've fought long and hard for disability rights, that the Supreme Court would base their decision on the notion that Congress didn't have sufficient evidence that there was, in fact, ongoing and systematic discrimination against people with disabilities, because that was another element of their decision. The decision was built on the notion that the 14th Amendment of the Constitution guaranteed immunity from suit to states, and it was their view that this immunity could only be disallowed by federal law if there was clear evidence that the issue was an ongoing pattern of discrimination, such as, for instance, they cited voting rights in places like Mississippi. Clearly there was justification of the federal government intervening in that case because there was ample evidence that people were being prevented from registering to vote. In our view, there is ample evidence as well that people with disabilities were being discriminated against. But in this case, as well as the case with regard to age-related discrimination, Garrett was a case that came out of Alabama, by the way. But in this case, as well as the age-related discrimination case, there was a clear question in the minds of the 5 Supreme Court justices that in fact there wasn't ample evidence, and we're very concerned about that.
Wow, that is an exceedingly heavy answer.
Yep.
I imagine that the answer that I just got is very boiled down from probably hours and hours of testimony and transcripts and whatnot.
Right.
Is there any place either within the ACB organization itself or on the World Wide Web where I could go to find out more about this?
Yeah, the Garrett decision, in fact, has been up on the ACB list in a number of places. I'm not sure that it's on our ACB website at the moment, but it is really instructive to read the minority decision as well, which is a very strongly worded document in opposition to the position that the majority took.
Where would I go about locating these documents?
You could certainly do that through the Supreme Court. But it'll probably be easier if you send me an email. Let me just go ahead and forward you the Garrett decision.
I'd be very interested in having a look at it.
Okay. And my my email address is very easy. It's Pedwards, P-E-D-W-A-R-D-S, @acb.org.
Doesn't get any easier than that. Well, thank you very much for your time. Thanks for coming on this time. And I've had the pleasure of hearing you address us at many of our New York State conventions over the past decade.
Cool. Thanks, Steve.
Thanks
have
a lot, Steve.
Jonathan.
Yeah, good to hear from you.
Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye now. What can you do about that, Paul? I mean, once the Supreme Court has made a decision like this, isn't this the end of the line? Can ACB do anything to seek to redress this, or is it really a case of protecting what hasn't yet been damaged?
Oh, I think there's a lot you can do. In what I think, there are 4 things that we're aiming to do. The first thing that we're obviously going to try to do is to get states to pass model laws that in fact give people the right to sue for damages. We think that forward-looking states will be interested in passing these laws, and obviously if a state passes the law, then state immunity doesn't become an issue. I think the second thing we need to do is to constantly go to Congress and say, are you aware that the Supreme Court, in fact, has challenged your right to make laws and is seriously infringing the rights of the legislative branch to take action that is taken in a very considered and appropriate way. I think the third thing that we can and should do is to persuade other elements of the disability community to join with us in putting pressure on Congress to eventually devote the time and resources to document to the absolute satisfaction of the Supreme Court that indeed there is systematic discrimination with regard to employment and within state employment against people who are disabled. Once that documentation is there, and it seems to me that then Congress can amend the Americans with Disabilities Act, if it chooses, to incorporate this new evidence. There are some people who are afraid of opening the Americans with Disabilities Act for fear that it'll be weakened. I don't happen to be one of those. I think that it may be time for us, after 10 years, to recognize that the ADA has not done as much for people with disabilities as it was initially hoped that it would, and we perhaps need to look at ways of strengthening it. And I think the final thing that we can do is the Garrett decision clearly indicates that both the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission and the Department of Justice do have the right to enter into suits for damages with states. And so we hope that we can persuade the Congress to allocate more dollars to both of these entities, as well as doing a better job of monitoring their effectiveness.
And from New York, New York, we go to Huntington, Connecticut. You're speaking with Paul Edwards.
Hello.
Hello.
Yeah, this is Barb from Connecticut. How are you doing?
Hi, Barb.
Yeah, K1EIR at ATT.net.
Uh-huh.
Listen, a couple of things. One is, how long do you think that it's going to take for this DVS thing to get straightened out?
Well, we think it's straightened out now.
Well, I know, but you know, the NFB knows. Are they going to bring it back to court?
Yeah, the NFB, as well as some other organizations, have issued a court challenge to the Federal Communications Commission's right to legislate. I don't have any idea how long it's going to take. We hope it will be settled this year.
I would hope so.
Once
yeah.
and for all.
Yeah.
We believe our position is very strong, and believe that the Federal Communications Commission made a good decision. Therefore, we think that the courts will uphold its right to make that decision. The FCC has been challenged in this way several times in the past, and much more often than not, its right to make the decisions it's made have been upheld in the courts.
Oh, absolutely. The other thing I want to say is that certainly you've done an excellent, outstanding job as president, Paul. All the things that have happened since you started, you know, it's amazing. How do you feel about ending your term now? Are you relieved?
Well, I think term limits are a good thing.
I think
6 years is a long time to be the leader of an organization and hold down a full-time job and try to have relationships and families and so on.
Oh, I know.
And so in a sense it'll be a relief. It's also just occasionally in the last year or so, it's gotten a little bit harder to push myself to the nth degree. So I think maybe it's time.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I can see. You know, but that's remarkable, and you know, especially holding down a job and everything else. It's a tremendous thing. Well, I imagine the elections will be on that Saturday then.
The elections will be on Friday.
Okay.
They'll start at about 10:30 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time on Friday. I don't think they'll be finished on Friday, so they'll go on to Saturday morning starting at 8:30 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time.
Oh, you don't think they'll all be finished Friday then? No,
I don't.
Wow.
But I can hope.
Yeah. Well, listen, great, and thank you, Jonathan, and I think, you know, ACB Radio is just fantastic.
Well, thank you.
And so long as
thanks very much. I appreciate that.
Yep.
Okay, bye-bye. That's something that people need to take into account, Paul, isn't it, when they're making their plans for the convention. I know that some people got a bit burned last year by organizing to leave on the Saturday morning, anticipating that the elections would be over when, in fact, there were a few things to do. And, of course, this year it is the officers' elections, and that's likely to be a biggie.
Well, you never know, Jonathan, until the time that elections happen. Elections will certainly be given priority over other activities, but of course we've also got resolutions and constitutional amendments that we tend to deal with as business on Friday and Saturday. It's a little bothersome to me how many people choose to leave before all of those things are done. I would obviously be much happier to see much larger numbers there on Saturday than there sometimes are.
Yeah, for me, Saturday was the time when all the meaty, really interesting stuff got debated and happened. I'd have hated to have missed Saturday.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. All right, let's go to Somerville, Massachusetts. You're speaking with Paul Edwards.
Hello, Jonathan and Paul. It's Brian here.
Hello, Brian.
Hi there. I wanted to tell Steve another great place to hear a bit about the Garrett case was on Laura Oftedal's April issue of ACB Reports. The opening segment by Melanie Brunson is all about the Garrett case, and I thought it was very, very well prepared. And she does quote from both the majority and minority opinions and give some ideas to the timelines expected to be involved in seeing future cases such as challenging 508 and Section 504 and a number of other federal laws and regulations associated with equal treatment under the law and by programs and services provided by our government. Cool.
that was the shortest comment of the night.
Okay.
Cool.
Well, what can the guy say?
That's true, I suppose. Did you have any other? I was just going to ask if you had any other questions or comments there.
Sounds like some excellent comments by your listeners here as usual, Jonathan. I'm always impressed by the quality of the questions and every once in a while by the quality of the answers.
Thank you too, Brian.
There you go. There you go.
Can you still eat some tornadoes now that you're slimming down?
Oh, well, what can I say?
Yeah.
Today I broke the diet and actually had a bit of filet mignon, but
oh man,
I allowed myself that little treat just today, once in a while. I'll expect to be able to show you the results of the dieting by the time we see you in July, Jonathan.
I'll look forward to that. When I shake your hand, there might not be anything to shake.
Just a bony wisp left there, I'm afraid.
Oh man.
Right now, though, I think that one of the things we all ought to be very aware of are the changes that are happening in the United States in terms of attitudes about what the government's role in the lives of its citizens ought to be. I'm very concerned not just about the challenge of the ADA and the challenge of this and the challenge of that, but also the attitude that the government ought not to become involved in the lives of the citizenry to any greater extent than is absolutely essential for keeping the sovereignty of the nation together. I don't think that that's necessarily what I have voted for in the past, and I'm very concerned about the current administration's attitudes in that regard as well.
Now, while you're both there, that raises another question I had on my list, and Steve has nicely covered the Garrett decision, which I had written down here. The Freedom Initiative. Now, President Bush's Freedom Initiative, at least on the surface, looks pretty darn good and actually appears to contradict the view that somehow government's got a hands-off approach to people with disabilities. It looks like a significant sum of money being invested by the federal government in the capabilities of people with disabilities. Or is it all just spin?
Well, Brian, do you want to answer that or shall I?
Well, let's do it as a team here. I don't know that it's all spin. But I can say that while there are some potentially excellent programs that will be funded by those revenues, I am concerned about the balanced approach that they will take. It's interesting that we're still sitting without a head of the Rehabilitation Services Administration, without a head of the Office on Civil Rights, and a number of other very, very important appointments. While we do get a lot of play on things such as the Freedom Initiative, there are certainly some core issues that have been left dangling, and we have a lot of reason for concern to be watching our government as those kinds of core issues aren't dealt with, while the fancy, sexy computer stuff got a bit of play.
I think if you look at the Freedom Initiative too, Jonathan, you can actually see a lot to support what Brian's talking about, in that a tremendous amount of money is actually being provided for small companies to make adaptations to the ADA. A lot of money is being allocated to set up private corporate approaches to integrating more people with disabilities. The amount of money that's actually being allocated within the Freedom Initiative to programs within the federal government that will make measurable differences is relatively minimal. I think the real question, and it's a question that applied as much to the efforts of the Clinton administration with regard to disability policy as it does to the Bush administration, frankly, is it's all well and good to fund departments and to fund initiatives, but unless you evaluate the effectiveness of those initiatives and unless you put those initiatives on a timeline that suggests that they're going to have results that are measurable and pretty immediate, you're not in the long run going to make a fundamental difference. I don't think that any of the federal initiatives with regard to people with disabilities have had a marked amount of success. I don't think that Clinton's employment initiative did very much, and I'm fearful that the Freedom Initiative won't do an awful lot because it doesn't have teeth. It doesn't, obviously, I'm not suggesting we go back to quotas, but we ought to be publicly and openly evaluating the success of these initiatives fairly soon after they're off the mark, and if they're not working, we ought to begin to pump money into areas that will work. I think there are some good things in the Freedom Initiative as well. I think some of the funds that are allocated to enable telecommuting from home are good. I think some of the funds that are allocated to states to encourage them to set up programs that would enable those folks who won't qualify under vocational rehabilitation to get access to access technology are good things. And I think that we need to perhaps at least be a little bit open to the notion that some of the elements of the Freedom Initiative may be of some real value. What I urge the Bush administration to do, however, is to evaluate how successful their initiative is and be prepared to make changes and to openly recognize that things aren't working.
And I'd like to second what Paul said with respect to the Bush administration as opposed to the Clinton administration. I, for one, was a very strong supporter of the Clinton administration, but even I had to admit that we did not see a great deal of successes during the Clinton administration.
Sorry, my microphone was off. It'll be interesting to see how that all pans out. It's funny how sometimes it seems to me that some of the big victories do appear to come through at the time of Republican administrations. I mean, the ADA was actually passed at the time of the first President Bush.
Yep.
Why?
Absolutely.
Why is that?
And credit should be given.
What's the reason for that? I'm fascinated by the fact that, you know, that a conservative administration, there does occasionally seem to be real huge leaps of progress like that.
Well, the ADA, I think, was very much a special case. And the history of the ADA's passage was fascinating because the Reagan administration had set up a national study that it was hoped by the Reagan administration would finally once and for all put an end to the federal government's involvement in disability issues. And this national study, contrary to the expectations of the Reagan administration, found that there absolutely was clear evidence of discrimination against people with disabilities that it simply couldn't ignore. And the the Reagan administration and then the Bush administration found themselves faced with the reality of their own study finding massive amounts of evidence of discrimination sufficient to require the ADA. And they had the courage of their convictions and followed through.
Hmm. Fascinating. I appreciate you calling in, Brian, and no doubt we'll be speaking with you sometime in June.
I hope so.
Excellent. All right, we'll catch you later. Oh, that was quick. He's gone already. Let's see. We're speaking with Paul Edwards. If you'd like to call in, the number is area code 212-812-2800, and the PIN is 0480-5512. Thanks to spiderphone.com, who make it all possible. That PIN again is 0480-5512. And finally, I've found the button to press. And we say hello to this unknown caller. Hello, you're speaking with Paul Edwards.
Hello, Dave McElroy here.
Hey, Dave, how are you? From California.
Pretty good, pretty good. I have to say, and I don't mean I don't mean to be disparaging, please, but I think one of the things that perhaps we're doing, I think we in ACB ourselves are walking behind the eight ball, because rather than looking at an issue and saying how can we solve the discrimination issue around blind people, not how can the government do it, but how can we do it? I think, you know, we are depending too blank much on federal involvement. I think we need to be taking a leading edge approach instead of saying, gee, isn't it too bad the feds aren't going to be as involved as they were. I'd like to say, for example, and with deference to Brian, who said, well, gee, Rehab Services Administration doesn't have a head. You know what? That really, I didn't know that until tonight. That's how much of a difference it makes to the average blind person. And I think we need to be really, we need to look at what can we do to look outside the box.
Well, David, with all due respect, that's rhetoric. Give me a practical suggestion about what we can do.
Frankly, I'm trying to think of one. I think, for example, if there are private companies being started to further ADA results, why aren't we involved in one of them? Why aren't we being blind people, not necessarily just ACB?
Sure. I take your point, and I, you know, I don't disagree with it. I would argue that we aren't relying on the government for results, or putting our eggs in the basket of the government by choice. I think we're doing it because of the way that the ADA was written. The ADA was written in such a way that it puts more emphasis and more teeth into the segments that cover the federal government, that cover state and local government. And I also think that because we're a national organization, we have a tendency to focus on things that we can do at the federal level. I would argue with you that in fact we perhaps haven't done as much as we could have or should have at the federal level. The other thing that I'd say to you, David, is because we're an affiliate organization, we are as strong in each state as our state affiliate is. In California, where you are, you have a very large state affiliate of ACB, and they would probably be able to carry through initiatives that we'd like to see them work on. I would like to see our state affiliates looking to strengthen, for instance, the white cane laws in each state, which I think at the moment are a joke. I'd like to see states working with state governments, as I said earlier, to pass model state laws that would protect state employees from discrimination on the basis of disability once they're employed. But obviously, we'd like to see those state laws go further and extend to the private sector. There are some state laws and some local laws in the country right now that do a far better job than the ADA does in assuring that people who are disabled and who are employed receive the kind of assistance that they're supposed to under the law and that common sense and justice suggests they should receive as well.
One other question.
Sure.
Stepping away from that for a minute, because I know I want to cover a couple of subjects here. One of the things I think I had noticed, the deaf community apparently went to private industry somehow, some way, and got captioning that way. Why were we not, and why did we not try to do the same thing for audio description? The only concern I think.
In fact, I should have answered that question earlier because I sort of let it slide. You're making an assumption, I think, that all of the funding that has supported audio description has come from the public sector, and that's not true. General Motors, for example, provided much of the funding for the audio description of the baseball series. And private corporations have been heavily involved in funding, I would guess, at least 50% of the audio description that's out there. Audio description has not ignored the private corporations as potential funders of audio description. And I think we need to recognize what a huge part the private sector has in fact played in making audio description possible.
I'm just obviously looking for ways that we can get what we need without being confrontational about it, and it's probably a pie in the sky, I admit.
Well,
but I think we do need to be, you're talking about the carrot and the stick approach, and I think we need to. To be, and I should talk. I'm trying to use a stick right now, as you know.
Yep.
In terms of my employment, but I do think we need to try to ride the crest of what is coming on. And I wish I were brighter than I am, because I'd like to, but I think there are many who are, and I'd sure like to see us look toward how we can push ourselves, integrate ourselves in whatever way we can. Without depending on the feds, which appears to be a problem right now.
Yeah, but thank you. But we're in fact not depending on the feds with audio description. We're for the first time saying it's up to networks now to find the funding within their own budgets. It's up to the movie industry to find the funding within the budgets of their own movies. It's up to the cable channels in the top 20 markets to find sufficient money within their own systems. And frankly, that's the reason there's opposition, because we're saying to them, okay, the federal government has demonstrated this works. Now it's up to you guys to do what's right. And,
yeah, and I'm sure you've got other phone calls. I'll let you go there, Jonathan and Paul. And thank you very much. And, Paul, your presidency has been great, and we hope things continue well in ACB.
Yeah, thanks. Right. Thanks very much, Dave. Okay, bye-bye now. We're speaking with Paul Edwards, and if you wish to get a last question in, the number is area code 212-812-2800. That's area code 212-812-2800. And when you're asked to enter a conference code, it is 0480-5512. That's 0480-5512. Do we take sufficient advantage, Paul, of blind people perceiving themselves as an economic unit? I was having a discussion with someone about this a few weeks ago, that there's a perception out there that if only we somehow realize that when all blind people get together, we are actually a significant force, that we should be able to win more battles through the market than we are as blind people presently.
I don't know that you can ever take enough advantage of that. I think there's an interesting parallel at the moment that went on with the conference in Canberra, Australia, suggesting that in order to object to the Bush administration's withdrawal of support for the greenhouse protocols, what people ought to do is to begin to boycott American oil companies. And I think there is some room for blind people to begin to raise some economic questions such as this with regard to audio description. I mean, clearly, if blind folks began to withdraw their cable subscriptions and to do other things of that sort, it would have an impact on on the economic well-being of some of these entities. Would it have a sufficient one to make a significant difference? I'm not sure. I think that the public opinion impact would be pretty large.
Let me,
larger than the economic impact.
Yes. I want to talk, as we start to think about winding down, about what it's like to be president of a significant national consumer organization of the blind, in terms of the... Can you give us some sort of understanding of what your week is like in terms of the time that you devote to ACB and the issues that you have to deal with?
Well, it varies a lot. I've tried to be a pretty open president, which means that I take calls from anybody who wants to talk, and I try to answer emails as I can. It's been a little bit difficult over the last year because of some of the personal catastrophes that have happened. We had a flood that destroyed one computer, and then a robbery that took one away, which has made things a little rougher this year than it has been in the past. But I would guess that I'd probably devote anywhere from 20 to 50 hours a week to being ACB president, in addition to a full-time job, and that doesn't include those weeks when I'm gone all weekend, which is about 28 weekends a year, to state conventions. And when I go to state conventions, I tend to try to be available or at least 18 to 20 hours a day. If people want to stay up that long.
What's kept you going? I mean, what's the motivating force for you to devote that kind of time?
Well, I think once I became ACB president, and I've got to tell you, I didn't rush out and seek it, but once I became ACB president, after the first 9 months of floundering around, I decided that what I wanted to try to do with the 6 years that I had to be ACB president was to do the best job I could at clarifying who and what ACB is so that we would be better understood by a larger group within the world, really, and also to begin to work on implementing a plan that had been adopted in the previous administration, a five-year plan. And the core of that five-year plan was to strengthen our national office and to make it more a centerpiece of ACB. So one of the things that I've worked very hard to do is to give our executive director a greater role to play within ACB, and I think Charlie Crawford has certainly risen to the occasion and has become the kind of ongoing leader of our organization's day-to-day operations that we need. Even though I continue to expect that our leaders of the organization, i.e. our presidents, will continue to be strong as well. But I think to have a central ongoing kind of head of government in Charlie Crawford, or head of the executive branch perhaps, I don't know, has made a tremendous difference in our ongoing presence, both in Washington and on the national level.
It's a fine art, isn't it, separating governance from management functions?
It is.
Yeah. When they look back at the Edwards presidency in a few decades' time, what do you expect or hope that you'll be most remembered for?
Well, I hope that I'll be best remembered for being a fairly articulate president who's been able to try to take the high road as often as he could in order to make it clear that there are still an awful lot of things that need to be accomplished for blind people, and that the American Council of the Blind is a vehicle that can accomplish those ends. I don't know how history will, in fact, regard my presidency in the long run. There have been an awful lot of very capable leaders before me. I think I've had some opportunities to become better known because of things like ACB Radio and the greater availability of the Internet that simply weren't available to my predecessors. And so I think history is going to have to take those greater opportunities into account. I think that I'll be recognized as the person who was president when ACB assumed a role that it was moving towards or had been moving towards for a long time, which is to be an articulate, clear, unequivocal, consumer-driven voice of blind people that was being very widely heard. I'm not sure that my presidency is responsible for that. I think we've got an awful lot of other people who've taken leadership roles in making that happen, including the whole board of directors, including the officers of ACB, and of course, including our staff in Washington. But I think my presidency will be remembered as a time when ACB emerged as a clearer and more articulate voice for blind people in the United States, who more consistently, I think, was articulating the interests and the concerns of the blind community than any other organization speaking for blind people has done.
Do you have any significant regrets that stands out at this moment?
One of them is the one I expressed earlier. I really have operated a lot during my presidency, sometimes I think to my detriment within ACB, to try to build bridges to the National Federation of the Blind, because of my real belief that the blindness community is too small to allow differences to dominate. I'm really very disheartened that at the end of my 6 years, we find ourselves perhaps at odds with the NFB more than we have been for quite a long time. I think it's important that we recognize, though, that the NFB, for the most part, is by itself. And while people perceive and are interested in perceiving the disagreements of NFB and ACB as two consumer organizations fighting with each other, in reality, it really is the NFB taking a position that's fundamentally different from that of the rest of the blindness community in this country. And I wish there were more ways that we could get that across. I would like it to be better understood that there are a lot more organizations than just ACB that are working on all of the issues with which we disagree with the Federation on, and most of those organizations are working on our side of those issues.
What sort of things will you be looking forward to getting back to? Because presumably, although you'll still have involvement in ACB, you won't nearly have the same kind of call on your time. Well, what else do you like to do?
Well, I truly am hoping to sometime this summer or fall get to the place where I can actually produce an ACB radio program on a regular basis.
Marvelous.
I'd really like to do that. As you know, Jonathan, I'm a folk music freak, and I'd really like to see if I can't persuade more people in ACB Radio's community to become interested in folk music and to share with them some of the music that I think is pretty good. And I'd also like to have a stab at doing some commentary as well. So I'm hoping that this summer I can go further with that. I actually did manage to get through the first tape of your tutorial last weekend.
Marvelous.
And so hopefully by the time my presidency is over, I'll be competent enough to be able to do something.
Now, that will be good. And if you're around at midnight on a Monday night, Eastern Time, ACB Radio Interactive does have Maureen's Cafe with a couple of hours of fairly folk-flavored type things.
Oh, good.
Yeah, and she,
I'll check it out.
She does a wonderful job. So I highly recommend that. In fact, every so often on my show, I play the Fred Small Talking Wheelchair Blues, and it was you who introduced me to that song.
Yes, it was.
And it gets a wonderful response. Well, the ACB history, I must ask you about that, as I do when you come on here. How's that shaping up? When are we going to see that?
That's a really interesting question. I'm very happy to tell you that I have in my possession, and I'm about to sign and forward, a contract for the production of the ACB history. I don't think that all of the text is completed yet, but I'm very excited by by the fact that a mainstream academic publisher has agreed to publish it. It's not going to be a vanity press production that we'll have to pay for. It is a publisher who sees the value of this work and who is prepared to produce it for sale at his expense. And it's a very large academic publisher from the Midwest in the United States. I think I was a little put off by the high price tag that we're going to end up having to charge for the book. I think that probably the book is going to cost close to $70 US. But that's cheap, unfortunately, as textbooks go. We expect this book will be about 600 to 700 pages and will be published in hardcover. We will, of course, be encouraging the Library of Congress through the National Library Service to very quickly produce accessible formats of these materials, and also have the agreement of the publisher that we can produce and sell a CD version of the book.
How will? What do you mean by an ACB version?
I didn't say an ACB version. I said a CD version.
Oh, I do beg your pardon.
Yeah.
I was going to say different versions of the book. A CD version of the book. Okay, and so that will be audio or text, CD-ROM or CD audio.
Well, I think that's still up in the air, and it may be one of the things that we'll try to work out during the convention this summer. Perhaps working some with you. In terms of determining how best we might do that, drawing on your expertise, so to speak.
Oh, wow.
Ideally, it would be. I think. Dare I say it? It would attempt to implement the NISO standards that are being incorporated into DAISY production, and perhaps would attempt to do both. So it would have a text version as well as an audio version.
That sounds terrific. So when do you think that this book will be in the hands of those who wish to read it?
I don't think that we can anticipate it being out much before November or December of this year. And frankly, we'll be lucky if it's out that soon. But that's certainly going to be the date that I'm going to aim for, or that I hope ACB will aim for. It'll be very much up to the History Committee to light a fire under the folks who are writing the book to be sure that they get the rest of their text completed in a timely fashion. My understanding is they're about 80 to 85% of the way through, but once the publisher gets it, they're going to have to do an initial galley version. Then they're going to have to produce the introductory material as well as the index, and so that's why I'm thinking that we'll be lucky to see it much before the end of this year.
Because this year is, of course, the 40th anniversary of ACB, so it will be a nice touch to manage to get it out in 2001, wouldn't it?
Well, I am excited that we can announce during our 40th anniversary year that, in fact, the history has been completed. And that it will be becoming available. And given the portions that I've had the privilege to read, I think people will find it fascinating. I've been very insistent, as has the History Committee, that we show our warts as well as our accomplishments. So we've tried to make it a real history rather than simply a partisan a partisan description of what happened. Obviously, it's informed by those with whom we've spoken, but the authors did make an effort, and in some cases succeeded in talking with some of the Federation sources during the breakup period, so that we hope that the opinions of both sides will be reflected in the discussion of what is often referred to as the Civil War.
Yes. I don't know whether... Did we give you a copy of the Association of Blind Citizens History?
No.
Oh, that's outrageous. I'll rectify that. But we had a very similar process for our 50th anniversary back in 1995, and it was a very challenging process to actually surrender the writing of the book to an academic who was, of course, not going to compromise their academic integrity in any way by doing anything other than say exactly what happened. And, yeah, that's the tricky bit.
We felt that was very important, and in fact, the two people who are writing the book are one of them is a journalist, and the other is a professor of history in North Carolina. Neither of whom are visually impaired, though their sister is well known in the blindness community. Her name is Kathy McGivern. And she at one point worked with ACB and subsequently has had a lot of other jobs within the blindness field at a national level, so is very well known in the blindness community. But the McGiverns who are writing this book are a husband and wife team in North Carolina, and they made it very clear right from the beginning that they weren't prepared to compromise their integrity, and we told them we wouldn't hear of it anyway.
And I must say that's one of the most wonderful, one of the many wonderful things about working for ACB, and I did post an email message, which I think you may have missed seeing, that made the point that never once have you or anyone from the Board of Publications or anyone at all involved in ACB sought to influence any of the current affairs programming that this radio station does. It's right and proper that ACB, what pays the bills, has ACB-related programming. But when it comes to current affairs broadcasts, there has never been not even an attempt to try and influence what goes out on the air, and that's what makes ACB such a unique organization to be a part of.
Yeah, and in fact, when you and I had talked about your participating, I know you had some question as to whether that was going to happen, and I assured you at the time and have tried to stick very closely to it that my interest in creating ACB Radio was to create a voice for all blind people. I would encourage as many Federationists as want to participate in ACB Radio. My belief has always been that the more open discussion of blindness issues there is, the better informed blind people are, which is obviously one of the reasons that I'm sad that we don't have more opportunities to hear the views of the Federation expressed through their leaders on ACB Radio, which would truly give listeners an opportunity to understand where the Federation is coming from.
Hmm. I guess that if you had wanted to set up ACB Radio in such a way that ACB influenced everything that went out, you wouldn't have asked me in the first place.
That's probably true.
I'd like to thank you for giving up another 2 hours of your Sunday where you are, and this is probably the last time that we'll get to talk to you as president, because it's not that long until the convention now. Gosh, it's going to be so much fun, and so I'd like to thank you for all of your support and for the effort that you've put in as president. We've read you in the Braille Forum from afar. You came to New Zealand back in 1999 and were a huge hit, and people still ask after you, and very quickly, you became not just a mentor, but a friend as well. I want to thank you for everything you've done for ACB Radio and continue to do for ACB. It's been a pleasure to have worked with you.
Well, it's obviously been a pleasure to get to know you and Amanda and the children as well. And you guys were wonderful hosts in New Zealand. I expect that long after I'm president of ACB, the friendships that I've been able to make as a result of being president of ACB will go on. So I expect to see lots of you, both in New Zealand and here, after July.
Well, there appears to be increasingly more of me to see, unfortunately.
I'm sorry to hear that.
Yeah, married life does that to people, I've found. But yes, you may be able to take a vacation out here, and we'll provide a special plate full of chads for you to eat so that you'll feel right at home. And it'll be It'll be beautiful. Have a good night, and I'll play a tune to go out with, and we'll keep in touch, and no doubt we'll hear your voice on ACB Radio Mainstream throughout the convention.
Excellent.
Okay.
Thank you, Jonathan.
Thank you.
Thank you for being a friend. Travel down a road and back again. Your heart is true, you're a pal and a confidant. I'm not ashamed to say, I hope it always will stay this way. My hat is off, won't you stand up and take a bow?
Thank you for being a...